get this second hour underway by welcoming back to the program, as we do every week at this time, our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, how's it going, Rich?
We're going very well here, thank you. You've been a busy man working that monument and getting some running in, too, I see.
Little bit of the monument, more running lately for some reason. I did run 9 miles the other day and climbed the monument 3 or 5 times. I don't even remember. And I forgot to put on my Vaseline. You know how it is with a nipple Vaseline.
Yeah, well,
I paid the stingy price for that in the shower and screamed like a woman. So there it was.
Today we want to talk about a little bit, and we'll talk more in subsequent weeks, about your new book. And God, it's a wonderful read. Buried on the Beaches, Cape Stories for Hooked Hearts and Driftwood Souls. I was saying earlier in the program, this is like the perfect beach book. Now, I'm not a beach guy myself, so for me, it's the perfect sit on the front porch with a coffee or some other beverage and read and get caught up in the lives of these people. Because, and I've told you this before, you have such a talent, such a gift for, in a very brief period of time, pulling us into these stories and making us feel like we've known these characters forever.
Yeah, thank you. It's something that I call Instatone. I should probably like patent that. It sounds like something I sell off the back of a wagon or something. But it's this idea that if you have the characters and they don't exist, but they're real, and I think that's more powerful by far than just existing, that they're out there, that you could go and meet them. And it doesn't mean that they couldn't live on the far side of Neptune, but they are out there. And with any story that I write, I have the characters. Sometimes I have the idea for what the story is going to be, but ultimately it comes down to the characters and what they are going to relay to me. Sometimes they relay that very quickly. Other times I have to lay in bed over a few nights and just wait for them to tell me what their stories are going to be. And I don't try to force them down any corridors they don't want to go down to or anything like that. They're going to surprise me. And we just have this relationship where I know if I'm patient, they're going to tell me what they want to be known, and then I'm just going to have to find the best way to convey that. And I think with beach reads, that's almost a pejorative term, because a beach read is something that we look at as reading light. It's piffle. It's something that you don't have to think about. And what I wanted to do was to create the best ever beach read, something that if you were some trust funder from Fairfield County and you just lived the life of the dilettante, or you were a hardworking plumber with her husband and you're at the beach and the kids are splashing around in the swash, I wanted to give everyone from those very contrasting demographics something that was a vacation inside of a vacation, and it did the work for you. It energized your brain, but it didn't require you to, I have to try to figure out what this sentence means. I wanted it to be ridden downhill, or like you're on a boat, you're being conveyed. And something also that was a work of literature, because I don't think anyone's ever once done that hybrid of perfect beach read and literature that can be around in 500 years. So that's what I was thinking.
Well, I'm no fan of piffle. I don't have time for piffle. This is not that at all. It is literature. And yeah, read it on the beach, read it on your porch, read it in your study with a fine glass of wine. You'll enjoy it either way. Is the connective thread among these stories this notion that anything that can happen to you can happen on the Cape?
The stories are set on Cape Cod, but when I was writing them, I had a number of things in mind. But one of the things I had in mind was people who lived in San Jose. And the reason I was thinking about people who lived in San Jose was because I wanted them to be able to enjoy this book every bit as much as the person who is out clamming right now in Chatham. I didn't want to make it something specific where if you were not from this region or you didn't pass through this region, although many people do, that's a help, that you would be able to connect with the characters because of their human quality. And you think about places in the United States where you can set a story that's informed by the flora and fauna. You can set a book. Because I don't really like the idea of story collections. I like the idea of books that have parts and parts that interact cohesively with each other. And you think about where could those places be if it's not a city, if it's not like New York or Chicago, Alaska, right? Something like that, Texas Panhandle. But to me, Cape Cod is this unique ecosystem. And you have the animals, you have the water, you have the bird life, all of this. When we're driving to the Cape, you notice how, like, the vegetation changes outside the window, and it changes suddenly. It's that scrubby brush, those cedars and everything. And I wanted to take people into that world where the flora and fauna were imparting themselves upon the people who live there, the people who pass through there. And when I was a kid, we didn't have much money, and we would vacation on the Cape. It was the type of place where you could have a cheap vacation and stay in a motel and get the kids a pail and me some flippers, and I'd go and look for rock crabs or whatever. Or if you were like a Kennedy, it's a place you could go. So I wanted to have it to be this, not necessarily a magical place, but this chimerical place where things could change and people could change. You could go there for the summer season and be altered. You could go into Boston to rescue your struggling artist of a brother and bring him there. And he would not necessarily be changed himself, but change the people around him. And I think the Cape is unique that way. So I wanted to write, really, again, I have these goals, the best book of Cape Cod literature there ever was that also transcended Cape Cod.
Well, we cross the Sagamore Bridge and begin with the first story in the book, The Cape Path. And right away, a couple of really interesting families. The Cape itself, a character in the books, but Banyan, his wife Ellen, the kids, Dace and Ellis. I love the Ellie. I love the relationship with them. She's a tomboy. He's more into old horror movies and things of that sort. And then their neighbors, Jimmy Mack and son Barrasso, who is in a wheelchair. And it just pulls us in instantly to the very interesting relationships between the families, inside the families, and sets us up for a fascinating story.
This man has a timeshare. His family has a timeshare in the Cape. And the person he left out, of course, in that litany of characters was his wife. His wife is not going with this man and his daughter, who's going off to college. And she has hurt her back. She had broken her back, in fact. And she's wearing a brace. And it looked like she was going to be paralyzed, but she's not. And like you said, he has this boy who's into famous monsters of Filmland magazine, kind of like Boris Karloff creepy stuff. And he doesn't really connect as much with his son, although he's trying to, because his daughter's going to be leaving in the fall. And his wife is not with them because her mother is dying. And she wants to spend that final moments with her. And she also does not want her family to miss this timeshare that they have every year. She sees this sort of final bonding moment for this man and his daughter. And when they're there, there is this path between these developments. You go to the Cape, you might rent a house, and you can find these paths. It wouldn't take you to the next development over and be like, ooh, that's a nice development than ours, or ooh, we have a better development than that. And they make their way across this path because of their friends who also come in from Cape Ann, and they have a timeshare there. And there's this kid that they end up meeting who's really struggling, and he is in a wheelchair. And the daughter is going to do something for this young man who thinks his life is not going to transpire as a man's would. It is something that is, let's just say, very sensitive for a father. Something that could really hit a father the wrong way, but is actually a magnanimous gesture. And that gesture involves a certain act, which isn't charity, but it's a kind of giving that, I mean, you've read it, probably don't really know anything like it. And they have this moment later back in Boston with the ashes of the now deceased grandmother. And the father kind of, I don't want to say confronts his daughter about what happened, but they have this epiphanic sort of exchange about why it had to happen.
Yeah, and what I like is that it's pretty free of judgment.
It is. It's a very judgment-free story, I would say, because sometimes things are going to appear to be a certain thing. They always are going to, almost always, not going to actually be that thing. And they're not going to be the thing after that thing, or the thing after that thing, or the thing after that thing. Maybe when we get like 7, 8, 9, 10 rotations in, we're going to start to get to that point where we say, oh, I've been looking to the right. I need to start looking to the left. And there will be the thing after that thing after that thing. And the father is willing to get to that place with his daughter, who has gotten there before him. And we hear that expression, the child is the father of the man and all that. It's kind of a moment like that where he has this aha sort of epiphany that my kid is, she's ready to leave. She's ready to leave our family and go off and develop on her own now. And it is judgment-free, and I think it's as touching as literature can get without you expecting to be touched in the way that you are, in fact, touched.
I would agree with that completely. We're talking with Colin Fleming about his wonderful new book, Buried on the Beaches, Cape Stories for Hooked Hearts and Driftwood Souls. The second story in the book, Potlatch, a term that I was not familiar with that plays into the story. Great. Can you explain what a potlatch is?
Native American term, and what it basically means is if you and I lived across the street from each other, as the characters do in this story, and you said, you know what, Colin, let's have a potlatch. I will give you my thing, and you will give me yours, and we can put them in our houses, and we'll just sort of live inside each other's skins for a bit. And I think, wow, Kimball has some really nice stuff. This is great. I feel like I've come up in the world. And you'd be like, oh, God, this is so bleak and depressing. Let's unpotlatch. And that's what happens with this guy. His name is Terry, and he is a rotund Boston sports fan who has gone through some difficult things. In fact, the first story in a different book of mine called Between Cloud and Horizon, the first story is called Terry from the Cape, and it's the same character. So this story here is actually a prequel to that one. And if you listen to or listen to sports radio, you always hear people like, oh, it's Rich from Bangor, Maine calling in, and people have a persona or whatever. And this Terry, this very large Santa Claus-esque man, who is, of course, decked out in like Red Sox sweatpants, Patriots beanie, and Celtics jacket. He's that walking sort of middle-aged sports bro. And he thinks he's this famous guy because he calls the radio. He's Terry from the Cape. And so this family across the street, this man's wife is basically encouraging her to help out this guy who has had this tragic loss. And the man's son is a youth hockey player. And if you play youth hockey or if you have neighbors, as kids do, you've seen these exchange programs where the youth hockey team from Quebec will come and stay with the kids in Braintree or whatever. And then you go up to Quebec with the host family. And there is a girl on the hockey team who comes to stay with this man and his wife who are doing the potlatch with Terry. And she ends up hitting it off with this lonely man across the street. And it looks at a certain point like maybe something not quite right has happened between the two of them. But it's really something else quite different. And again, I think pretty touching.
It sure is. And there's I underlined this and dog-eared the page because I love this description of the relationship between the narrator and his wife, Kath. And you write, she was one of those people whose heart, in one of my father's favorite expressions, never took so much as a day trip from the right place, whereas everyone else's can get a bit rangy from time to time. I love that description.
Yeah, that's true. It's like funny. We think about parts of us over here, parts of us over there, and how often are we centered on the right place that we should be centered upon, and we have off days, and certainly our hearts have off days, but the idea that your heart never ranges far from the home it's supposed to reside in is, that's a nice compliment. It makes me envious of him, really, to be honest with you. I don't have any of these things in my life. This is all stuff that I've invented, and I wrote this book at a time, this is way back in 2012, when my own life had fallen apart, and I couldn't go anywhere, and I didn't have any money, more than I have now, but there was nothing that I could do, and it was the summer, and I wrote this book as a way to travel, to go somewhere in my mind, and I realized when I did that, like, whoa, travel isn't just about, like, going to India and taking selfies and posting them on Facebook. In fact, it's not really about that at all. And what I wanted this book to do was to redefine the very locus of travel and what it meant to go somewhere. And you don't actually have to sometimes go further than closing your eyes at your desk and traveling that way.
Although I'm inclined, even though they're not real, I want to go find a place like the rusty scupper, or more likely, says the flounder.
Yeah, that's Chicks and Quarters, and that's the third story. And it's one of those ones that ultimately, what I try to do is I try to write every single thing I do to the exact same qualitative place. That is, I don't think anything is worse than anything else. I don't think anything is better than anything else. And that's what I try to do on the radio, too. And I don't think there's a segment that's necessarily better than one or one that's worse than others. But others, people will have their own personal preferences. And ideally, your preferences will change at certain times in your life, depending upon what you're going through, what you've learned. Some might come back to you stronger than they were the first time. You might put others aside and grow more deeply into others. Chicks and quarters for me, and that refers to lobster sizes. If you get lobsters, you know that. Like, chicks is one size, quarters is another size. They cost different amounts of money. And that's one of the stories that means the most to me that I've ever done. And it does things with temporality, where this man is working as a whale watch spotter on the Cape one summer. And he's studying to be something else. He plays in the band, drummer, and life hasn't really gone, even at this early stage, the way he wants it to. At one point, he's living in a porn theater, and he's living behind the movie screen.
And I love that description, yes.
He's like basically like living inside of this fake orgasm all the time. The soundtrack's asleep, and he meets this guy wearing a shirt that says, "Give me a jab." And he's all disheveled, and this guy lives an adventurous life. And this newcomer says to this other guy, he's like, "But you have to admit, it was pretty exciting, wasn't it? Like, you felt like you were really living when you were living behind the porn movie theater screen." The guy's like, yeah, I did. And this guy, the newcomer, Stokey, he's this legendary guitar player. And he ends up playing the solo that becomes part of the local lore for a long time. And the narrator of the story is ostensibly writing a newspaper profile on this infamous Cape Cod moment years after the fact, like at those small town papers, right? The Ridgefield Gazette or whatever it may be. And he's running this back through his mind as he's older now. And turns out that this guy, Stokey, he has this young girl who's showing up at this place he lives, this horrible rooming house that used to be a place that crabs and lobsters, there's a fish market, were sold at, hence chicks and quarters, because you can still see the buckets that they were in with the labels. And this woman keeps showing up, this young girl, and Stokey ultimately leaves. He disappears. And we find out later who the young girl was. And I think, for me, like, there is no way, right? You saw that coming.
No, not at all.
Like, you're kidding me. So you're in the past with this story, and then you're not in the past at all. You're in the present, and it tweaks temporality unlike anything I've ever seen. And even when I still read it back, or I look at it, or I remember it in my mind, I think, wow, that reader, there's no reader who is going to guess that that's how that story is going to end. Nobody would ever see that coming.
Well, and I found myself equally caught up in the story of Gibber Stokes recording local bands. And then when they listen to the playback, they're like, "That's not me. I don't sound that good." And I thought, well, where is this going? Is it Gibber? Is he playing? Is he somehow dubbing in his own work? What's happening here? And that distracted me from finding out the identity of the young woman. So well played there.
That's the plan with that, because sometimes what you're doing with readers is you're telling them something, but you're not like really getting the seed under the ground, because you want them to forget about it for a while. Not completely forget about it, but like kind of top of their brain forget about it. So when you come around again, there's pleasure in recognizing something that was hinted at. It's like an ego thing. It's like you pat yourself on the back. You're like, "Oh, I remember that." And that feels good. And these stories, even though there are very serious things happening in them, they feel good. They ultimately, I think, feel good even in their sadder aspects. They're very reaffirming. And this guy, Gibber Stokes, he's also this, I guess, engineer you'd call him. But it's the 1980s, which means you're showing up with your portable tape recorder. And he's recording these bands, these Battle of the Bands concerts, where people are just doing Yardbirds and Cream and Doors covers, that kind of thing, right? They're not like writing the new version of Yesterday. And this one guy is hearing himself in the playback. And this guy had some success in the music scene. He toured as like a sixth guitarist, right, with like some 80s band. The guitarist who
stayed off stage, right?
He's off stage, right, like behind the curtain. You don't know he's there. But maybe if you like read the tour program, it's like with assistant guitar from, right? He's that guy. And he hears this tape that's made of himself, and he just does not believe it, because he knows how he sounds. And all of a sudden, he's like, he's Hendrix. He's Cape Cod Hendrix. And so he's confronting this mysterious person who has shown up in the midst of all of them, saying, like, what gives here, dude? And it kind of gets ugly, but it works out in, first of all, kind of a sad way, kind of like a ghosting way. Mm-hmm. And then it works out in a very real, romantic, loving way for somebody else. And ultimately, a friendship is sustained through these two people who are never going to see each other again.
Yeah, although I love what he says, the narrator says about Stokey when he's trying to send a letter off to him and says, he was the kind of man that things found.
Yeah, I don't think I'm a person like that, but I think we aspire to be people like that. We're suspended to that last port of call the person was in, even if they're 6,800 miles away and it's 7.2 years later, it's going to get to them. And I think when you're the type of person where it gets to you like that, it doesn't even matter that it physically gets to you, because you carry around certain bonds of connectivity that never go away, that are powerful because they don't even need to be articulated. They're known. Ultimately, the best things in life boil down to is. And is, that's why it's the most powerful verb. It's just, this is. There's this moment in Crime and Punishment, where Raskolnikov is sitting there with the prostitute, and neither of them know what to say. They're both in these horrible situations. And Dostoevsky just writes, life is. And it's one of the best sentences you could ever have. And I think this Stokey guy is a life is kind of character personified.
Wonderful stories, incredibly memorable characters. The book is Buried on the Beaches, Cape Stories for Hooked Hearts and Driftwood Souls, the latest from Colin Fleming. Get a copy. You will love it. It's going to make your summer. I look forward to talking about some of the other stories in the book in subsequent Tuesday visits. Colin, we thank you as always.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.